You're listening to LawPod UK. It's a podcast that discusses developments across all aspects of civil and public law in the United Kingdom. All the comments are current at the time of podcast publication. LawPod UK is produced by the barristers at 1 Crown Office Row.
I am Emma-Louise Fenelon from 1 Crown Office Row Chambers, and here with me to talk about the importance of clinical guidelines in clinical negligence cases is Pritesh Rathod, also from 1 Crown Office Row. Pritesh, welcome.
Hi.
You may be able to hear a little bit of background noise. We apologise for this. There's some drilling going on nearby, near Chambers. Pritesh has practised clinical negligence at 1 Crown Office Row for over 11 years, and over that period, he tells me, he has dealt with cases covering every imaginable part of the body. His work is split roughly 50-50 between claimants and defendants, the latter including instructions from NHS trusts, private hospitals and medical defence organisations. He is, I hope, going to share some of the insight he's gained in that time. Pritesh, in what kind of cases are clinical guidelines likely to come up?
It's complete chance whether clinical guidelines will form a major part of any case that I'm asked to advise in. I know that there's some research being carried out into this by Professor Joe Samanta and others at De Montfort University, but in my experience it's quite random. Some cases might involve issues around the standard of surgical technique, others might involve disputes of fact as to what care was actually provided, but it's the cases that involve clinical judgments being made that are the most likely to involve consideration of clinical guidelines.
And when you're advising on a case involving clinical guidelines, how do you decide how much weight to attach to them?
Well, there are no hard and fast rules about the importance of guidelines in a particular case, even if the case does require a consideration of clinical guidelines. But from a barrister's perspective, a claim is all about presentation. Now, there are some statistics going around that last year only 120 clinical negligence cases involving the NHS went to trial. But even though that is so, always at the front of my mind is how is this going to look at trial? Litigants have to present their cases based on expert evidence, and I'm always assessing how persuasive will this evidence be? How will this look in court? Because although we have clear laws about what the duty of care is, what the standard of care is, and the burden and standard of proof, cases are, after all, decided by judges who are human. And you can't discount the human element in a case. It has to be remembered that by the time a case gets to trial, both sides will have supportive expert evidence. And the human factor may well influence the likelihood of a judge preferring one expert to another. An expert's case may or may not be supported by the guidelines. And how reasonable this position is depends in some measure on how reasonable it looks.
Can you give us an example of a case in which clinical guidelines featured?
Sure. I was asked to advise a claimant who'd suffered a venous thromboembolism following lower limb surgery. The pharmacological VTE prophylaxis that she'd received was aspirin. Now, the relevant NICE guidelines suggested that heparin be prescribed, and the evidence that we'd obtained from a haematologist supported this view, arguing that heparin was much more effective in preventing blood clots than aspirin. But the specialism of the clinician whose conduct was being impugned was orthopaedic surgery. And so it was orthopaedic surgical opinion evidence that was admissible in relation to the question of breach of duty. The orthopaedic expert took the view that there was a responsible body of medical opinion that would support the prescription of aspirin rather than heparin, presumably because surgeons are concerned with the risk of post-operative bleeding. And my instructing solicitor took the rather unusual step of obtaining a second opinion from another orthopaedic surgeon, which I'm sure is frowned upon in the civil procedure rules. But the second opinion was no different, and I had to advise, therefore, that the claimant had no claim. To take another example, I was asked to advise this time a defendant, who I shall refer to loosely as a hospital. And again, this was a case where the claimant had suffered VTE following orthopaedic surgery. And again, as in the previous case, the pharmacological VTE prophylaxis that the claimant received was aspirin. But in this case, whilst the orthopaedic expert argued that there was a responsible body of medical opinion that supported the provision of aspirin, he was distinctly uneasy about defending this position in court, given the relatively better effectiveness of heparin and the acknowledgement on the hospital's part that had heparin been given, the VTE would have been prevented, and I therefore had to advise that the case be settled out of court rather than going to trial.
So how do you reconcile both cases?
Well, on the face of it, it looks like I've given inconsistent advice. And if you looked at the second case in an abstract way, one might ask, well, surely you should have advised that the case was defensible. But I think such a perspective overlooks two factors. Firstly, and this is true for most, if not all, clinical negligence cases, a case is only as good as your expert witness. I was faced with an expert who was very shaky about his position and who probably would have crumbled in the witness box under cross-examination. The risk of him doing so outweighed the chance of him standing up to questioning and the benefit that that would bring to our case. Secondly, however, and one important matter of detail in the second case, was that the hospital's own guidelines stated that NICE guidelines had to be implemented by a certain date, and they hadn't been. So put in other words, the hospital's own local guideline ought to have been that heparin was provided after surgery rather than aspirin. And not only did this likely influence the expert's opinion, it certainly influenced mine.
So it sounds like you're suggesting there's a hierarchy of guidelines.
Well, I would suggest that one can formulate perhaps a broad rule of thumb along the lines that the importance of a guideline in a particular case is inversely proportional to the importance of the body that wrote it. It's often been the case that higher-level guidelines are seen simply as a guideline, and I've had many an expert witness tell me that NICE guidelines are only a guideline. They don't prescribe a standard of care. This appears to be the orthodoxy amongst medical opinion, and I think a similar statement can be made about GMC guidelines. The failure to follow Royal College guidelines, or adopting a practice consistent with such guidelines, may go some way in assisting a litigant in proving or disproving negligence, respectively. But the failure to follow a local guideline, which is set by the impugned clinician's own employer, who is vicariously liable for such a failure, is much less defensible and, in my view, would look unimpressive at trial. One expects hospital employees to follow internal guidelines, and if there was a failure to follow it, there had better be a good explanation.
I imagine, however, that like all good rules of thumb, there must be exceptions.
Where a clinician has followed a local guideline, it doesn't automatically mean that a claim is unmeritorious, in other words, defensible. The clinician may well face criticism for slavishly following a guideline rather than tailoring his or her advice to the individual circumstances of the case, a sort of damned if you do, damned if you don't scenario. Or the guideline itself may come under attack as being outdated or irresponsible, possibly even by reference to Royal College or NICE guidelines.
How difficult is it to bring those latter sort of challenges?
They're, in my experience, more difficult to make. Local guidelines are usually written following research and specialist input, together with considerations about resources. I've seen challenges to guidelines attempted in a few cases on the basis that they don't represent a reasonable and responsible standard of care. And I've seen those sorts of challenges succeed in even fewer cases.
Are there any other factors that affect the weight attached to clinical guidelines in your experience?
My perception is that judges are sensitive to arguments about the scarcity of resources, as indeed are expert witnesses. To take another example, I acted for a claimant who developed post-operative upper limb ischemia following upper limb surgery. He needed transfer to a specialist centre by ambulance, but there'd been what's called a purple surge, meaning that the ambulance couldn't meet the national response targets for getting him there in a certain period of time. This resulted in a delay, which no doubt contributed to his poor outcome when he was ultimately transferred there and operated on. But our emergency medicine expert was unwilling to criticise the ambulance trust, opining that resources were stretched and that the ambulance service couldn't be criticised for not responding in time, notwithstanding the adverse effect that this had. Likewise, I perceive that judges too would be uncomfortable about becoming embroiled in such arguments about resources. because although they wield great power and influence, judges are unelected. Constitutionally, it would place them in a very difficult position if they were seen to be passing judgment on the appropriate distribution of public funds. And so I think challenges to guidelines, which incorporate considerations about the allocation of scarce resources, would be difficult.
It's interesting that you bring up resources. As anyone that practices in the field of clinical negligence will be well aware, clinical guidelines in relation to maternal request or elective caesareans have been in the news much recently. NICE guidelines indicate that women should be allowed to undergo elective caesareans, but Birthrights, a human rights in childbirth charity, using data gathered from a Freedom of Information request, reported in August this year that just over a quarter of NHS trusts fully complied with the guidelines. In the discussion that followed, one of the issues that came up regularly was the cost of elective caesareans relative to natural birth. Have you any views?
I think, and this ties in with my point about resources, one factor that's often cited, and indeed has been cited to me by many an obstetric expert seeking to defend the failure to offer a caesarean delivery, is the cost of conducting such a procedure. But the fact that such procedures are costly didn't stop the Supreme Court from ruling that the pursuer in that case, and women in other cases, should be offered all options for mode of delivery, notwithstanding the apparent cost of a caesarean. And the case I'm talking about is, of course, Montgomery. Baroness Hale of Richmond, now President of the Supreme Court, said this, and if I may be permitted to quote, "A patient is entitled to take into account her own values, her own assessment of the comparative merits of birth in the natural and traditional way, and of giving birth by caesarean section, whatever medical opinion may say, alongside the medical evaluation of the risks to herself and her baby. She may place great value on giving birth in the natural way and be prepared to take the risks to herself and her baby which this entails. The medical profession must respect her choice, unless she lacks the legal capacity to decide. There is no good reason why the same should not apply in reverse if she is prepared to forego the joys of a natural childbirth in order to avoid some not insignificant risks to herself or her baby. She cannot force her doctor to offer treatment which she considers futile or inappropriate, but she is at least entitled to the information which will enable her to take a proper part in that decision."
One of the interesting things about Montgomery for our purposes was that the Supreme Court considered and effectively implemented the GMC's guidance on informed consent and the NICE guidelines on caesarean sections.
Yes, so much for these documents only being guidelines and not prescriptive of a standard of care then. Perhaps, therefore, my proposition that the importance of a guideline is inversely proportional to the importance of the body writing it should include a qualifier to the effect that the importance of the court considering the guideline may mitigate this inverse proportionality. But what I think was most remarkable about Montgomery, and why I think some medical practitioners have found the decision difficult to accept, is that it was a very clear statement that the doctor knows best attitude of old can't be allowed to persist, particularly when it comes to allowing patients to make treatment decisions for themselves. The Supreme Court rejected the application of the Bolam test and indicated a willingness to look behind the justifications put forward by the obstetrician and the hospital's expert witnesses.
So do you have any predictions for the importance of clinical guidelines in clinical negligence cases going forward?
Montgomery is, I think, a reflection of a more general trend amongst the courts to scrutinise more carefully the evidence being put forward by medical practitioners. Gone seem to be the days when judges simply deferred to the greater expertise of medical practitioners. Judges themselves are intelligent people, and they like to see for themselves if a particular course of treatment can be justified. In recent years, I've had cases where judges have looked behind the evidence of experts and clinicians in order to examine whether the clinician's conduct was negligent or defensible. And if such a trend continues, as I predict it will, we may well see more of a willingness on the part of courts to look behind clinical guidelines and the learning and considerations that go into forming such documents as well.
Pritesh, thank you very much for coming on the podcast, and we hope to have you here again soon.
Thank you.
For more editions of LawPod UK, you can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes and recommend us to a friend.